From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. First of all, this hour, I talk with former gubernatorial candidate Christian Fong. Fong is unveiling the Iowa Dream Project this week. He says its goal is to activate Iowa's next generation of conservative thinkers. Then, what was that fireball streaking across the midnight sky last night? We'll look into it. And finally, at the end of the hour, Justin Feinstein of the University of Iowa. His new study offers some interesting news for caregivers and loved ones of individuals with Alzheimer's disease. It shows that while memories of Alzheimer's patients may be lost, the associated feelings can linger. First, a look at this hour's news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Did you have a meteoric experience last night? What did you think was happening when that fireball crossed the sky? Everybody's talking about it today. We'll be talking about it in a few minutes. In fact, we're going to be talking to Steve Spangler, professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa, to find out more details about that unusual fireball that lit up the sky. If you'd like to join our conversation with a particular meteoric experience you had last night, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Before that, this week, former Republican gubernatorial candidate Christian Fong is unveiling this week the Iowa Dream Project. Fong says Iowa needs a new conservative revolution. And so he says this project will promote conservative solutions to tackle the challenges in education, economic development, and community renewal. Joining us now to discuss the Iowa Dream Project is Christian Fong from our studios in Des Moines. Good afternoon to you, Mr. Fong.
Great to be with you, Ben.
Tell us more about the Iowa Dream Project. What prompted it, for instance?
Well, 2010 is the year when Generation X and millennials finally become half or even more than half of Iowa's population. Essentially, the next generation is the majority of Iowa. And yet, in 2006, we saw that that older Iowans vote at twice the rate of younger Iowans. Younger Iowans simply aren't involved. So at the onset, this is saying, how do we get the next generation to engage and involve themselves in the civic process? And we're giving them a platform. We're taking the civic discussion to where they are, that is, on the web, right? Mm-hmm. They know how to organize. They know how to talk about the issues on the web. And so at the website, theiowadreamproject.com, there's going to be a full suite of ways that that younger people can get involved in the discussion.
I was at your website earlier today, watched a couple of the videos, so people can chip in videos with their take on this, right? So it's sort of a discussion platform.
That's right. I mean, anybody that has a Facebook account, for instance, we're used to, you know, going to somebody's wall on the Facebook page and interacting with them, interacting with their ideas, something that they've posted, and there are running discussions. And I find when it's people that know each other and there's a face attached to it, we get past the slogan shouting that mm-hmm. characterizes so much of modern politics. And instead, we actually start to engage with ideas. So what the Iowa Dream Project is doing is giving, you know, the modern internet platform to the political process, more or mm-hmm. less, and saying you can engage, young people can engage in ways that they know how, but do it in a way that's ideas-based, that's a positive tone and solutions-oriented.
What are some of the conservative solutions you would tout to tackle the challenges in some of these areas? Let's take education.
Well, when you look at education, you know, we really are looking at the end of an era. Rather than holding on to, you know, how many teachers' jobs can we keep and having the discussion of how do we fund the current system that's in place, I believe that the conservative solution is to be focused on the kids, saying what do they need to learn to be prepared for the workforce and for college. We need a full-scale round of innovation, if you will, in the education. The way I describe it often is what we're doing now, worked in the 20th century with the Industrial Revolution. This is like an education factory. Kids go in, you put in a certain number of math units, a certain number of language units, and you hope that what comes out the other side of the factory is something that works. Well, that's not the world we live in anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We're dealing with a need for full-scale innovation, and I think a lot of the conservative themes of looking to the community and looking to the individual for the solutions is how those innovations are going to emerge.
And on the jobs front, economic development, how would you approach it differently than is presently the case?
Well, it's tax day, so let's start right there. We all are stinging from paying our taxes.
But for 95% of Americans, taxes have been reduced, right? All but those making more than $250,000 a year.
Well, the track that we're on has led us, in the state of Iowa. And let me just speak specifically to our own situation here in Iowa. Higher taxes, choosing to borrow money to continue spending at the state level as opposed to, tightening our belts like most families do, it has led to job loss. And so, proof is in the pudding. I think, economists can sit around and discuss why certain things happen, but the average Iowan is looking out there saying what we're doing isn't working and we need a change. And today, change means getting our spending under control, having government focus on how to help businesses succeed instead of how to regulate the businesses that are currently in existence. Mm-hmm. They're kind of classic conservative solutions, but at the moment, it's the counterculture. It's the alternative to what we've been doing.
Mm-hmm. What you're describing and the need that you're seeing this project filling makes me think that there is some failing in the conservative movement, a failing in the Republican Party, that somehow you haven't been reaching out to Iowa's next generation of conservative thinkers. So what specifically do you see as the past failings that you want to correct or do better with this project?
I had a county Republican chair who's a Gen X, as I am. He came up to me a couple months ago, and he said, "I'm thinking of disengaging." I said, "Why?" He said, "It's not that I'm not a Republican. It's that the Republicans aren't even talking to me anymore." I think among young Iowans, whether it's Republican or Democrat, the partisan brands no longer are working brands. It's associated with a style of politics that's anti-this, anti-that, and dig in your heels and let's fight it out. What the conservatives need to do, and let me just back off because this is a nonpartisan platform. This is not about promoting the Republican Party, although I think the conservative ideas are ripe to be embraced by the next generation. This is about telling young people, when it comes to fixing our state's future and looking out 5 to 10 years, don't just look to the political parties. Don't just look to the candidates that are in place. You, Gen X, you millennials, have the ideas and the dreams that are going to make the state work. Mm-hmm. And so 5 or 10 years out, what do you want to see Iowa look like? Now come to the site, come to theiowadreamproject.com and engage in a discussion of the ideas about our future.
Okay, I won't use the label Republican, but you do call for a conservative revolution. You cited statistics for participation in the 2006 election, but we saw record participation among younger voters, the people you're reaching out to, in the most recent presidential election. So is this lack of participation among this age group or among those who identify themselves as conservatives among this age group? Are they there?
Well, we saw record participation, but that still meant only 2 in 5 young people showed up to vote. And by the time the majority of people aren't voting and we call that success, I think we just have to look in the mirror and say, no, honestly, that is not successful to go from 25% to 40%. Now, it's an improvement, but we've got to do better than that. When it comes to, are young people conservative, are young people liberal? Generation X, the numbers will show Generation X is the most conservative generation in the state of Iowa. It's the only generation that voted for McCain over Obama. The millennials clearly are voting on a more liberal perspective. But the issue here, while as a Republican and as a conservative, I hope that young people will find something in the conservative themes that addresses in a positive, solutions-oriented way the issues they're facing in job creation, and improving schools, and improving their communities.
Mm-hmm.
But bigger than that, you know, we have the fourth fastest rate of brain drain, Iowa does, in the nation. And until we start getting our young people involved, whatever their ideology is, unless they begin to engage in making their communities and this state better, we can expect to continue to lose them. So, yes, I believe that the conservative ideas are the right solutions for the issues we're facing, but I want young people to get engaged and involved from whatever their background is.
Mm-hmm. When I see you, when I hear you list off the areas that you're focusing on, you know, education, economic development, community renewal, I see that you're leaving out the social issues. That's by design. You also include the social issues or not, such as gay marriage. We know that polling shows gay marriage, for instance, to be a non-issue, non-controversial issue almost among under 30 voters.
Yeah, let's talk about how we're doing the messaging in this project. I think so often we assume that there's going to be a political leader that's going to step in and say, this is what you should believe, follow me there. The beauty of the internet is that it goes from being a one-to-many conversation to a many-to-many conversation. We're talking to each other through Facebook, through YouTube, through those platforms. We've already begun to invite people, and some of the videos have begun to arrive, people that are already leaders among their peers to talk to their peers about the civic issues. Now, what are they going to talk about? So far, you know, this is how we got to these three topics of job creation and community renewal and innovation in our schools, because this is what the young people are talking about right now. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to do some central planning around
what
the message
should
be. I want young people to talk about the issues they care about. And I think if we get to November and we've got 200 or 300 videos up and not a single one of them talked about some social issue, whether it's gay marriage or otherwise, that tells us something as a state. Mm-hmm.
So you think social issues are really not on the front burner for the young conservatives?
I think they are a different sort of social issue. I think when you talk about better schools, I think young people consider that a social issue. When you talk about a philosophy of let's spend it now and then we'll tax a future generation, they see that as a justice issue. So rather than divide things between fiscal issues or social issues, I think people that are younger just look at it and say, does this work or not? Is this working to create a better future? Is this sustainable? And whether it's a social issue or not, I guess I'll let the pundits decide. But for young people, I just want to get them talking.
Just a few seconds left. Let me leave you with this. How much of this is an effort, Christian Fong, to keep yourself in the political arena? Some might see it as that. Do you have future political ambitions, having pulled out of this race for the governor?
I'm flattered that that people think that I've got a political future. You know, before I ran for governor, what I was really engaged in was getting the next generation involved across the political spectrum, and I'm continuing to do it.
Christian Fong, I want to thank you very much for joining us from our studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Christian Fong, thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
And when we come back on The Exchange after a short break, we're going to talk to Steve Spangler, professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy, about that fireball that crossed the sky last night. Did you see it? We'll talk about it in just 1 minute. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Glad you could join us over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's the buzz around the neighborhood and in offices today. Did you see it? Last night, just after 10 o'clock, a very bright meteor was observed streaking across the Midwest sky. A fireball was seen over the northern sky, moving from west to east. Well before it reached the horizon, it broke up into smaller pieces and then was lost from sight. This fireball was seen across not only Iowa, northern Missouri, Illinois, Indiana, southern Wisconsin, and several reports of a prolonged sonic boom were received from areas north of Highway 20, along with shaking of homes, trees, and various other objects, including wind chimes. Joining us now, two people at Iowa Public Radio in this very building in Iowa City who saw it, Alex Hoyer and Jeff Schmidt. Let's go to Alex first of all. Where were you when you saw it?
Well, like you said, Ben, I was just outside of my apartment. It was just after 10 o'clock, and I was walking to my car to get something, and I was walking, I guess, west, and I saw this bright flash of light, looked to the north, and I saw this what looked like this yellow ball just streaking across the sky.
Did you know immediately it was a meteor, or did it look like it? Other thoughts cross your mind?
Well, the first thing that popped into my head, and it was brief, but I thought that it was a plane that was crashing that was burning up. But I quickly realized that it probably wasn't that, because it was moving really, really quick. And it kind of disintegrated and got a little bit smaller. So then I thought that it was a meteor.
Jeff Schmidt, you were driving when you saw it.
Yeah, heading south of people, eastern Iowa area, know Highway 218, heading south of Iowa City, right on the Johnson County, Washington County border. It lit up my car, meaning it immediately got light in my car. The perception was, oh, there's a semi coming up behind me, big headlights. I looked behind me, no vehicle. I said, what is that? It was behind me. I glanced up behind me while I was driving and caught kind of the tail of the meteor quickly flashing across the sky. Immediate thoughts, are they shooting off fireworks here on the Johnson County, Washington County line? I thought airplane. And then, you know, you think, I've never seen that before. Is that an unidentified flying object? Just that stuff jumps into your head. Mm-hmm. But it was amazing to see.
Jeff Schmidt with his sighting south of Iowa City, north of Riverside. Alex Hoyer with that sighting of the meteor in Cedar Rapids. If you had a sighting and had some strange thoughts or feelings, we'd like to know about that. We've got a few minutes to discuss this. 1-866-780-9100 for your meteoric experience. 1-866-780-9100 or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Joining us also, Steve Spangler, professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Iowa. Steve, you've got a good case of envy today, because you were not in the number of people who saw it.
Yes, indeed. I'm green with envy, just like the color of the light that some people said they saw. And so I did not see it. I went out twice last night to look at the sky, which I always do in clear nights, but once around 8 o'clock, once around 9 o'clock. But that wasn't at the time this occurred. So I wish I had seen it.
Okay, so we're sure it was a meteor. How big was this? Visible 4 or 5 states across the Midwest. This is an unusual event.
This is an unusually bright one. I looked at the video on the KCRG news and read something about the descriptions of it. This sounds like an unusually prominent one. There are, if you go out in a dark sky setting, and wait for an hour or so, you'll see shooting stars. Those are a common phenomena. And bright, like fireballs, as they're called, are, you know, rare, but nonetheless you have a good – I've seen many of them in my life. I haven't seen one like this. So this was – the basic view was this was probably a particularly large object impacting the atmosphere. Meteors are due to solid objects entering the Earth's atmosphere, heating up and causing the atmospheric air to glow. This was probably a larger object than most of them.
When we say large, basketball, table-sized, what are we talking
about?
That's
a good question. I don't know, and I think they probably won't know until they recover fragments of this thing, which they probably will. But the folklore is a standard shooting star you'd see in the night sky might be the size of a grain of sand. Something the size of a tennis ball would produce a prominent fireball. This one, who knows? My guess is it's probably somewhere between a basketball and a small truck. They get to be very large. I mean, there have been – the one that produced Beringer Crater in Arizona was a couple hundred yards in diameter. But that's – that we're not talking about that now, because there's no crater, for instance.
Let's go to another person who cited it. Ray is calling from Mason City. Hi, Ray. Where were you when you saw it?
Well, I just went outside, sat in my front patio, and just watching the stars as I normally do, and all of a sudden, flash caught my eye, and I saw that beautiful tail and ball going across, and to me it looked much lower than it probably was, because I would have said that the ball looked like about the size of a volleyball.
What were your first thoughts as to what it was?
My first thought it was just shooting star, but it was bigger than a shooting star. But I knew pretty well that it was a meteorite or something like that going by.
Professor Spangler, was this part of a meteor shower, or is this something quite different?
No, it isn't. This is a time of year when there aren't much in the way of meteor showers to start with. There is one in about 10 days from now, that is a relic. It's called the Illyrids, and then there's another one in early May called the Eta Aquarids. But they're fairly weak meteor showers. And this, from all the accounts, was coming from west to east, which is not the direction one of those meteors would come from. So that's it's not one of those. So I think probably what it was is a small asteroid. There are asteroids that have orbits that come into the inner solar system. Most of them stay out between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. But there are ones that come into the inner solar system, and it hit the Earth.
1-866-780-9100 to report your sighting of this magnificent meteor that streaked across the sky, Midwest sky last night. 1-866-780-9100. The exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Clark is in West Union. What did you see, Clark?
Well, I didn't see it. I was in the house, and the house shook and rumbled and scared the dog, and the dog wanted inside. But my daughter was coming home earlier, about 10, 15 minutes earlier, and she said she saw something look like lightning. And I was in the house at that time, and the house rumbled. And I haven't heard any reports of any earlier meteor fragment, but I'm thinking that there must have been an earlier one than the one that everyone else saw.
So Clark's tale here, his account, along with reports of prolonged sonic boom, receiving people in areas north of Highway 20, shaking of homes, trees. What does this indicate about where this meteor landed?
Well, I think you just have to see where people saw it and where they stopped seeing it. From what I've gathered, it's sort of the last the indicator that it came down somewhere in Wisconsin. From what I was seeing in the papers.
And in West Union, you can feel the shaking of the house.
Well, that's interesting. I think that sometimes large meteors will produce sounds. There are large sounds of a variety of sorts. Part of the reason for this is that they're traveling at supersonic speeds. Some of us who are old enough can remember the days of sonic booms in the 1950s. These things are traveling much faster than the speed of sound, so create a large sonic boom. That will be one of the sounds. The other is they'll create sounds like thunder, because thunder is caused by the expansion of the very heated gas in a lightning strike. Well, a meteor is producing a hot column of gas for the same reason. So those are two of the things that can produce these noises. And people talk about other kinds of noises that aren't well understood that meteors can produce. But again, large meteors in the past have produced sounds very similar to what people are describing. So that goes along with the phenomenon.
Yeah, very quickly, it seemed to break up before it reached the horizon. You can see that on the video. What does that indicate, that it might have burned up completely?
No, it probably just fragmented. That's normally what happens, is you have some large object, it's heated up, and the thing breaks apart as by a combination of the thing being heated and the aerodynamic stresses on it as well.
Okay, very good. We'll be back in just a moment to conclude our discussion about the meteor that crossed the sky yesterday evening. Steve Spangler, a professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy, with us, and we'll be back with your accounts of this meteor in the sky. Unusual Media, this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And the thoughts that you had when you saw this meteor, what were they?
This could be the beginning of the end for the human race. For what men first thought were meteors or the often ridiculed flying saucers are in reality the flaming vanguard of the invasion from Mars.
Looks like they're going to come out of that gully pretty soon. We'll have to rush our defenses to be ready when they do.
Guy can need plenty of reinforcements.
We'll get them. Lieutenant, look!
They slash across country like scythes, wiping out everything that's trying to get away from them. That explains why communication is cut the moment their machines begin moving.
Montreal's blacked out. Nothing more has come through.
Same thing that happened on the Pacific coast. Anything from them yet?
No, Mr. Secretary. We've had nothing.
Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still buzzing about that meteor that crossed the sky last night. Many of you saw it. Many of you are calling in to tell us about it. 1-866-780-9100, as we discuss it. It turns out is an extremely historic and rare occurrence. We have with us Steve Spangler, professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa. What kind of precedents are there for a meteor of this size and spectacular nature?
Well, there's some interesting historical cases here in eastern Iowa, in particular what are called the Marion meteorite and the Homestead meteorite. And these occurred in 1847 and 1875, respectively. The one that the Marion meteor and meteorite are the actual fragments that they pick up on the ground afterwards, occurred the day the University of Iowa was founded. So clearly they found the pieces of it near Marion. Homestead is, of course, a town out in the Amana colonies. And in 1875, there was an extensive description of an event that was similar to this. And once again, we have pieces of this that you can see here at, for instance, Iowa Hall at the University of Iowa campus.
What kind of dangers do meteors pose? Has anyone ever been hit by a meteor?
Yeah, people have been hit. It doesn't happen very often because they're rare occurrences, and a person is a pretty small target. But there have been cases, I think in the last 10 years, one came through the roof of a house in Chicago and hit someone, and someone had a broken hip from one once. But if you're in neurotic about worrying about things, this is pretty low on the list of priorities. So.
But it was. Wasn't it, in fact, the latest the most popular theory as to the extinction of the dinosaurs was something like this, only much larger, I would imagine.
That's right. There's still questions about exactly what killed off the dinosaurs, but it's pretty clear that at least a major contribution was what they call an asteroid impact. But the only difference between an asteroid and a meteor is in terms of size. This one, like I said, I would guess was somewhere between a basketball and a Volkswagen in size. The one that hit the Earth 65 million years ago was probably 5 miles in diameter, so it would have packed much more of a punch. But there are similar kinds of objects. Again, it's just a difference of size.
Carrie is joining us from Cedar Rapids. You saw the meteors, Carrie?
Yes.
Yes.
It was extraordinary. And I'm so glad to hear everybody else calling because I had no idea what it was when I saw it last night.
What did you think?
I was, I live in a very quiet, very dark wooded area on the southeast side of Cedar Rapids. And I happened to just go out around a little bit after 10 to take the dog out. And as I turned around, there was a flash of light. And I think opposite of what other people are saying, I experienced total quiet. There was no movement. And I looked above the rooftop of a house in front of me, and if you were to hold your arm out in front of your face and spread your pointer finger and your thumb apart, you could see this line, this flash of a bluish and then bright orange streak just slowly. It was almost in slow motion, just moving across the darkness of the sky, and it disappeared behind the rooftop of the house behind me, and it was like the other caller said, maybe 5 seconds that seemed to be moving in slow motion, but the brightness and the vibrancy of the colors and the quiet was just striking. It was beautiful.
So not even a delayed sound, because the light would reach you before the sound. Nothing after that.
No.
Nothing at all.
Nothing. And it looked like I was thinking that it was at the tail end, whatever it was at the tail end, because it almost just disappeared, not because I couldn't see it anymore, because of the houses or the trees, but because it almost dissipated as it got to what would have been the rooftop of a two-story home. And there was a slight rustle of the trees afterwards, which made it a little bit more mysterious and cool. But it was the color is what struck me, because it really lit up the sky in a sense, but it was more of a bluish hue at the tail end. So at the left side of the streak, it was more of a greenish-blue color. The tail of it, and then
these colors, Professor Spangler, is that what's burning? Is that iron coming down? Or
I think that people see colors first of all because this is a very bright one. It turns out that in the human eye, the ability to distinguish color turns on when the light is sufficiently intense, and so I think that is why even the normal ones would probably have a similar what we call spectrum or distribution of colors. But it's relatively faint, and so your eye, the part of your eye that detects color can't pick that out. But the color, some other people mentioned green, that is probably excited oxygen atoms in the Earth's atmosphere. There also, if this thing was rock-like, which was very likely, magnesium will also show greenish colors if it's evaporated in an excited state. So I think that this is just and you can also things like red or orange or characteristics of gases, glowing, what the colors you get from glowing gases in the atmosphere, the materials these are made of. So I think what the reason you're seeing these colors is that the temperature in the wake of this meteorite and the meteorite itself as it was coming down are thousands of degrees, and so things begin to glow at those temperatures.
Carrie, you are very lucky. I envy you, and Steve Spangler, our professor, envies you. Let's move on
Indeed.
To Tom in Pella. Tom, you saw it.
Yeah, I did. I was, like everybody else saying, I didn't know what the heck I was looking at, but I was in my living room just talking to my wife, and I looked out the front window, and it was from where I was sitting, it was kind of low on the horizon, and I think I caught just the end of it. But I shouted to my wife, said, oh, my goodness, and we're running for the front door and headed outside, and when she was like, what? My initial reaction is seeing it was like I was seeing a small plane or something going down in flames. And I had, I hearkened back to the images of the space shuttle, coming into the atmosphere and tragically blowing up.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I thought about it, I thought, I'll bet there was an asteroid, but that was my initial reaction.
It comes to think, we know a lot about these. Professor Spangler is telling, with modern science, we have known for several generations that it's not witchcraft or things working on us. But when you think about hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, what people must have thought when they saw this?
Oh yes, I mean these things were magical objects. It was fortunate yesterday. I was teaching in my class on solar system astronomy. We talked about meteors, and one of the things I pointed out to them was how important these things were to societies, before we knew the scientific explanation for them. For instance, some meteorites are iron in content, and these are called nickel-iron meteorites. And they found a dagger, an iron dagger, in the tomb of Pharaoh Tutankhamun, and it was meteoritic iron. This was at a time when it was still the Bronze Age, and they couldn't make iron out of extracting it from iron ore. Somebody saw this meteorite or the meteor descend, found the meteorite, and they fashioned it into a dagger for the pharaoh. And there are many other societies where it's clear they found these things and attributed great sort of mystical power to them.
All right. Very good. Thank you very much. We'll end it there. Thank you so much for coming in on the spur of the moment. Steve Spangler, professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Iowa. We'll hopefully discuss this in the days to come when they and you are sure they're going to find something.
I'm not sure they'll find something. I think it's very probable given the description of it. But it's I think there's a real good chance they'll find the fragments.
Okay. Professor Spangler talking about the historical precedent here, the 1847 Marion meteor, the Homestead meteor in 1875. And this one of last night, perhaps they'll call this one the pre-tax day meteor. We don't know. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. A new University of Iowa study offers some interesting news for caregivers and loved ones of individuals with Alzheimer's disease. It seems to indicate that while patients might forget a joke or a meaningful conversation, the warm feelings associated with that experience can stick around and even boost their mood. This study was published this week in the early edition of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Justin Feldstein is the lead study author and a University of Iowa doctoral student in clinical neuropsychology. He joins me in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Good day, good afternoon to you, Justin.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
How was this study conducted? Tell us, how would you test whether people remember a memory or a feeling associated with a memory?
It's an excellent question. It's very hard to dissociate these two things. All of us have gone through this. Think back to a close loved one dying. Every time you would think of the death, remember the death, you'd feel sad, and every time you felt sad, you would think of the death. So this concept of memory and emotion, they're intertwined in our everyday life. And what we wanted to do is kind of dissociate these two things. And the way we did it is we studied a rare cohort of individuals with what's called antegrade amnesia. These people are unable to form new memories, so their day-to-day experiences kind of just wash away.
Okay. So physically, if we would look at a model of the brain, do we know enough about the brain to see where the memory of the actual incident is stored and how that relates physically, the geography of the brain, to that feeling? I'm trying to get a picture of this.
Yeah. So the way the memories are set up in the brain, and what we're talking about here is sort of short-term memory. Like, what did you have for breakfast today? Or what did you do last night? Or the memory of the meteor falling.
I didn't watch the meteor, unfortunately.
So those sorts of memories get consolidated, and they kind of get transferred into long-term storage.
Right.
And that transferring process requires a structure in the brain called the hippocampus. It's kind of a structure buried deep inside the middle aspect of the brain, no bigger than your pinky finger. And this structure, like I said, is critical for transferring short-term memories into long-term storage.
Mm-hmm.
Without this structure, all of the memories, all the things that are happening in your day-to-day life, like I said, would not be consolidated. It's like they never happened.
Now, what could these findings mean for changes in care of patients with memory disorders?
Well, what we know about patients with Alzheimer's disease, let's start with Alzheimer's,
mm-hmm.
is in the early stages, you find a very similar sort of amnesia. And at the same time, if you look at the brains of Alzheimer's patients, this area of the brain, the hippocampus, is highly impacted. It's one of the first areas, in fact, to be hit by the disease. So what our findings basically suggest is that these patients with Alzheimer's disease quickly lose their memories. And they lose their short-term memories first, then as the disease progresses, it goes backwards in time. Even though they don't have their memories, though, the emotion can continue beyond their memories. It could impact their lives beyond their memories. And you may not realize this. So, for example, like you talked about, you tell them a funny joke or you go and visit them. Even though they might forget the joke or the visit 5-10 minutes after it's over, those positive emotions that arise from those experiences could last. They could linger.
So we are walking around in our lives, also people without memory problems, without Alzheimer's, being buffeted by emotions that have been triggered by long-forgotten memories.
Absolutely.
That's fascinating.
Absolutely, yeah.
Did we know this before?
Well, you know, I think it's hard to dissociate these things. You talk to someone who has, say, post-traumatic stress disorder from the war. Take a veteran who just came back from Afghanistan and saw a horrible explosion and saw all his colleagues and comrades get blown up by this and has a violent sort of horrific memory, right? He's going to tell you that he's stuck with that memory and he's stuck with the grief and the tragedy associated with that memory. But what we're finding is these are two separate processes. The memory and the emotion are actually separated in the brain.
So take me a step farther. You've got someone with PTSD. They have these. Now, where does your finding, your study, lead to a better treatment to dissociate those two things?
Well, you know, for a while now, there's this notion in society that you could selectively erase painful memories. And by doing so...
That's in some movies I've seen.
Oh, absolutely. It's part of Hollywood. It's part of, I think, our thought process. If I could just get rid of this memory, I'll feel better.
Mm.
And you could take someone who's gone through a traumatic event and they're in the process of experimenting with drugs, for example, to try to get rid of these memories. And the idea behind this is you get rid of the memory, you'll get rid of the suffering that's associated with the memory. But what these findings are actually paradoxically suggesting is you could get rid of the memory but still have the emotion.
Mm. I wanted to talk a little bit about the methodology of this study that you conducted because you showed individuals with memory loss, clips of happy and sad movies. And we actually have a clip of one of the movies that you showed them, one that many have seen. This is Forrest Gump. Do you want to set this up? How would this have been used? So if we were the test subjects, what would you do now before we played the clip?
So we have patients with amnesia, and remember, they could only hold things online for a couple minutes. So we had these sort of short, powerful movie scenes. Forrest Gump is an example of one of them. We had a scene from The Notebook where a lady who has dementia actually forgets her own husband. We had scenes of people starving, children dying. These were very powerfully sad scenes. And then we also had complimentary happy scenes in a separate experiment. So we would show them the movies, and they would just simply watch them and openly experience any emotions that may arise.
Okay, let's listen to this scene from Forrest Gump. And this scene is of what part of the movie?
I believe the scene that you're going to play is towards the end of the movie after Forrest Gump has lost his wife and he's standing at his wife's gravesite.
So Forrest Gump at his wife Jenny's gravesite.
I don't know if Mama was right or if it's Lieutenant Dan. I don't know if we each have a destiny or if we're all just floating around accidental-like on a breeze. But I think maybe it's both. Maybe both is happening at the same time. I miss you, Jenny. If there's anything you need, I won't be far away.
Forrest Gump there. So what did you observe the Alzheimer's patients that were tested? Were you watching their faces as they watched this video?
So just to clarify one thing. So the patients we tested actually were patients with a very, you know, select form of antegrade amnesia.
Not Alzheimer's.
Not Alzheimer's patients per se. But they would watch these videos and they would react appropriately. I could tell you a couple of the patients were actually crying during some of these films.
Mm-hmm. And then you took them after this, after watching this. What did you do then immediately?
So after watching about 20 minutes worth of these short, powerful film clips, what we would do is about 5 to 10 minutes afterwards, test their memory for them, try to get a sense of what they're able to retain. And sure enough, as you would expect with someone who has very severe amnesia, they forgot the film clips.
Forgot the film clips. Okay. That you've tested that clip, that memory of sitting there watching Forrest Gump is gone. So how do you know the feeling is still there?
So after we assessed their memory, and it was kind of a detailed memory test probing a number of different aspects, we tried to say, you know, all right, what are they feeling now? The memory for what triggered the emotion is gone. Are they still feeling any emotion? That was really the million-dollar question. And what we found out is about 10, 15, 20, even 30 minutes later, the patients were still feeling the emotion. So if it was the sad films, they were still feeling an immense state of sadness. And the way we essentially probe this is through a detailed questionnaire asking them, how are you feeling right now? Please tell me.
Mm-hmm. What did you use for the happy movies?
Oh, we had a range of sort of hilarious and funny scenes, Robin Williams comedy sketches, America's Funniest Home Videos, the scene in When Harry Met Sally, in the restaurant. So we tried to do a range of sort of amusing, funny clips.
Mm-hmm. Did you find out which feelings lasted longer, sad or happy?
Interestingly, sadness stuck around, and it surprised us. And some of the patients, even though 5 to 10 minutes after the films were over, they completely forgot the films, they were still feeling sad 30, 40 minutes later. Happiness, I'd say, lasted about 15 to 20 minutes.
So what's going on in our brains when we feel happiness or sadness? Is that a chemical in our brain that lingers?
It's a great question. You know, we don't know exactly. This sort of study of how long emotions last is really only starting to unfold in our field. It could be a neurochemical floating around in our bloodstream, propagating the feeling. It could be some sort of bodily response in our face, a tightness in our gut, that's sort of cueing us into how we feel, or it might be these sort of images resonating in our mind. We're not sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of us enjoy sad movies, enjoy feeling bad in a way about Forrest Gump losing Jenny and other things. We seek these types of films out. So can we call it an unpleasant feeling if we seek it out?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, in some ways, at the other end of grief is sort of a light at the end of the tunnel. People feel relief. They feel like this enriched their life in some way. So not always. I can't say you could always call it an unpleasant feeling. Now, certainly while you're feeling it and experiencing it, it's unpleasant, but maybe you learn something from it.
So what is the next logical step for you as a researcher here? As someone on his way to becoming a neuropsychologist, working on your doctorate. Yep. This has made a huge media splash, not only in the country, but around the world, hasn't it?
Yeah, I was surprised to see countries like Poland, who just went through a horrible tragedy early this week, were talking about it in a lot of their popular press. And throughout the world, they seem to be interested in this idea of how is emotion and memory intertwined.
What is then the next step of research for you? What do you need, based on what you found out here, what do you want to find out in the future?
Well, a lot of people in Iowa don't realize this, but right in your backyard is the world's largest registry of patients with focal brain damage. Right here at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, we have hundreds and thousands of patients with very selective forms of brain damage that we're studying and conducting research on. And the next step is to really take other cohorts of these patients and put them through a similar paradigm where we expose them to emotional material. And I'm really going to try to look for the areas of the brain that are responsible for holding on to the emotion. We now know that memory itself doesn't seem to be too important for the emotion. But what are the brain regions that are important for holding on to that emotional experience?
Mm. How far does your interest in brain research go back in your life, to your teens, earlier?
Yeah, so I started about 10 years ago in college in San Diego. And as I was studying the brain there, using different forms of methodology, I learned about the patient registry at Iowa, and that's when I decided I got to come here to do research.
I'm sure we'll have you back because your research is absolutely fascinating. I'm riveted. We've run out of time, so we'll look forward to having you back, talking about more research that you have. Thank you for coming in to talk with us, Justin Feinstein.
Thank you.
He's an advanced doctoral student in clinical neuropsychology at the University of Iowa, talking about a new study that shows while memories of Alzheimer's patients may be lost, the associated feelings can linger. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins, Jeff Schmidt, and Alex Hoyer. Our producer assistant today, Christoph Mai. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio available. If you caught some of the show, didn't catch all of it, go get the podcast at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for joining us.